So, as it was alluded to earlier, today is the second of our two-part introduction to the book of Hebrews. We're going to be looking at Hebrews for the next kind of couple of months, probably. And yeah, really excited to dig in. So today, the kind of task for today was, how do we read Hebrews? I'm going to use the idea of the old and the new to think about how we approach reading the book of Hebrews. So I wanted to start by just saying that in Hebrews there are kind of three levels that we need to think about. We have the kind of direct context of the book. So when was the book written? Where was it written? Who wrote it? Who were the original audience? And what was God's word through that writer to the original readers? But to do this, when the Old Testament is referred to in Hebrews, we then have to kind of take a step back and look at that Old Testament context as well. What was going on at the time? What was God doing? What were the people doing? What was going on? And why is the writer using this story to make some kind of point? And then the third level is reading it today. So these stories, these letters, were collected and preserved for a reason. They're God's word to us now. So we need to be remembering to listen to what God is saying to us as well, not just in the abstract past. And so our main idea of this whole series is basically to look at, what does this book tell us about Jesus, and what is our response going to be? And today we're going to set ourselves up to investigate what the writer of Hebrews has to say about Jesus. We're going to try and put ourselves in the shoes of those original readers to try and understand what the writer was saying to them about God and what God had done through Jesus, both in their recent history with Jesus, but also thousands of years before in the Old Testament times. So I just wanted to recap a few points from Chris's intro last week, just so we're all on the same page. So the book of Hebrews is written a bit like a letter, but it's not the same as Paul's letters. It reads a bit more like a sermon. If you read it out loud, it takes about like 40 minutes, which may be a bit of a long sermon, but it's about that length. And there's kind of one clear argument all the way through, and it's spattered with encouragements and challenges, just as a preacher would do. We don't actually know who the author is of Hebrews. Scholars have different ideas about who it could have been, but no one knows for sure. So we're just going to refer to them as the writer. And we also don't specifically know who the audience were. We can assume that they're a group of Jewish Christians because of the number of Old Testament references. And it also sounds like they might have been facing some kind of persecution and they were struggling in their faith, maybe drifting away. And the message in Hebrews is for us too. So as I said before, we need to be listening. We need to be prepared to be encouraged and also maybe challenged in the next couple of months. And then finally, as Chris reminded us last time, a bit of study of the Bible can really enrich our Bible reading. We don't need to think of reading the Bible as either study or God speaking to us. They go hand in hand and they really kind of enhance each other. So as we study, we can expect God to talk to us too. So, old and new. The writer of Hebrews uses lots of Old Testament references, and she uses them for a purpose. They're not just saying, this is what it says in the Old Testament. There's usually a message behind, like there's a purpose that they're using this quote. There's kind of a general theme throughout, which is the writer is highlighting the old. This is how it used to be. This is what happened before Jesus came. And that was fine. But look at what Jesus has done. This is the new. This is even better than what came before. The new kind of trumps the old. And as I said before, the original readers were persecuted, wondering if believing in Jesus was really worth it. And some might have been drifting away, getting complacent. And the purpose of the letter is to remind them how great Jesus is. Jesus is better than anything. It's a call to a deeper understanding of who he really was and to see how amazing he is, and a call to respond in faith, and a real faith that leads to action. I'm quite excited to look at Hebrews because I think it can really help us to understand the unity of the Old Testament and the New Testament. So what do I mean by this? Well, Jesus didn't exist on earth in a vacuum. He was physically born to a human mother. He grew up in a fairly normal Jewish family in Israel, Palestine around 2000 years ago. He existed as a human in this very specific context. He would have grown up studying the Torah, the first five books of our Bible. He would have gone to the synagogue regularly. And this context wasn't an accident. God didn't just kind of close his eyes and drop Jesus in somewhere. This was on purpose. God had been working through the people of ancient Israel already and preparing the way for Jesus. And as we'll see throughout this series, Jesus was the fulfillment of God's plan to save his people. Many aspects of the old are fulfilled in Jesus. He was the new messenger bringing God's final word. He was the new and improved Moses who came to truly rescue the people. He was the new ultimate priest restoring connection between God and humanity. And he was the once and for all perfect sacrifice, bringing about God's new covenant. And we're going to go into these over the next few weeks, so don't panic that I've just skipped over them all. And we know that Jesus himself understood all these things as well. In the Gospels, we often see Jesus quoting the Old Testament and putting himself right into it as the fulfillment. I can't remember what the reference is, but there's an example. He's in the temple and he reads a passage from Isaiah. And he basically says, it's talking about me, which is a very bold claim. The point is that Jesus isn't just better than the old, he fulfills it. There's a continuity here. And this is why we need to understand the old to fully grasp the new. We see the seeds that God sowed throughout the Old Testament, which then come to bloom in Jesus. And we have a Jesus-tinted lens through which we can read the Old Testament. And we should always be looking out for clues, for foreshadowing, for echoes of what Jesus will be and do throughout the Old Testament. It's not just a book of abstract ancient history, but it's the beginning of the story, the opening acts where God was starting to work out his rescue plan and preparing the way for Jesus to come and complete it. So this is why it's important to embrace the old part of the story. Understanding the old helps us to get the context that Jesus came into and fulfilled. It helps us to better know all the different and amazing aspects of who Jesus is and what he did for us. So given all this, we're going to look at a few verses in Hebrews today as a worked example to see how the writer reads the old in light of the new. Now, hopefully it will set us up well to approach the next few weeks. And before we dive in, I just wanted to share a top tip for approaching some of these Old Testament references in Hebrews. So when the writer quotes a verse from the Old Testament, they would have expected their readers to immediately know exactly what they were talking about and have the whole story in their head. So as I said before, it's widely agreed that the original audience would have been Jewish. They'd have been brought up in that culture. They would have lived and breathed the Torah and sung the Psalms regularly and know them as well as we know the hymns that we sing. It's likely that they would have even memorized large sections of the Old Testament and the law. So a single phrase would serve as a reminder for a whole story or song. So I just came up with some examples just to help this idea come across. So imagine I was speaking to the church, as I am now, and used the phrase, light of the world, he stepped down into darkness. Do you know what I'm referring to? You know the song, yeah? Mm-hmm. So the song is Here I Am to Worship, mm-hmm. And I'm sure many of you know it. Most of you instantly recognise it just from that small sentence. And it's almost like the sentence acts as a shorthand for the entire song. If I use that quote in your head immediately, you have the content of the song. But not just the content, it kind of the emotion maybe, or the feeling you get when you sing it, or so maybe a memory of when God's spoken to you through it, or maybe its cultural importance, its association with the charismatic movement. So for one small sentence, it does a heck of a lot of heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. However, if I use that phrase outside of this context, you know, maybe I quoted it at work to some colleagues, they would be a bit confused. It's like they would know what the words meant themselves. It's not that the language is different, but they wouldn't get the meaning, that cultural reference that we have. And if they wanted to understand what I was saying, they'd probably have to do quite a lot of research into 20th century Western Christianity. So when we speak to people that we have something in common with, we use these references that kind of outsiders wouldn't necessarily get. And hopefully you can see the parallel here. We haven't necessarily grown up learning and memorizing the Old Testament, so we're going to have a bit more work to do to understand these references. Each of the quotes and references in Hebrews is not just about the words. It carries a lot more baggage than that. Another example, take the phrase, make America great again. So the words themselves, the words themselves have meaning. If you look at it out of context, those actual words seems okay, doesn't it? So imagine you've been in a coma for 10 years, you wake up and hear someone say this phrase, that sounds okay. Something's clearly gone wrong in America and this person wants to make it better. That sounds great. I can get on board with that. However, most of us will probably know that that phrase is now associated with a very specific political movement. Mm-hmm. If somebody says it, you kind of automatically know where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. You know that they have got a very specific idea of what they mean by it, and it's not just words. Their words carry baggage. So the point is, a quote isn't just words. If we want to get a better picture of what the writer of Hebrews is getting across, we've got to do some legwork. Remind ourselves of many Old Testament stories along the way. So, I thought it would be useful to look at an example. Sue, I believe you're doing the first one next week, our next talk.
Am I?
Are you? Yeah. I don't know. Jeremy said you're doing it.
I am.
So, good. Well, I'm glad we're all on the same page. So, I've pinched a couple of verses. I've finished a couple of verses from Hebrews chapter 2. I don't know if it's next week.
Yeah.
You and Jeremy can stop for it. But yeah, I've finished a few verses from your section. So
go ahead.
It only covers a very small bit, so I'm sure you still have plenty to talk about. And before I get into this, Jeremy shared some resources on the WhatsApp group last week. I have been listening to Tim Mackey, so if any of you have also listened to Tim Mackey, you may recognise some of my ideas, so I have to give him credit where it's due. Right, so Chris, do you want to put the passage up? Don't give it away.
Sorry.
Okay, can everyone see? It's a bit small, but hopefully you can see it okay. So we're going to look at Hebrews chapter 2, verses 5-10. First of all, can I have a volunteer to just read 5-8, if you can read that, or from your own Bible? Oh, thanks, Chris. That's better. Any volunteers? Julian, have you got it?
No.
Okay.
I can read it.
Okay, go on, Esther.
I'm just going to use it to read
it. Yeah, go for it.
It is not to angels that he has subjected the world to come, about which we are speaking, but there is a place where someone has testified. What is mankind that you are mindful of them, a son of man that you care for him? You made them a little lower than the angels. You crowned them with glory and honour and put everything under their feet.
Thank you. I love that in verse 6, it's like, oh yeah, someone somewhere has said this. It's like the writer expects us to already know exactly who he's talking about. And you might have spotted, but this is a quote. Quote from a psalm. Did anyone spot which psalm it was?
8.
Psalm 8. Very good. And we actually read this psalm last week as part of our worship, didn't we? So either that was a happy coincidence or well planned. So much like a preacher could have quoted Light of the World, and we would have been reminded of that whole song and all the associations that come with it. Bless you. The writer here is preaching Psalm 8 and is expecting the reader to just know exactly what he's talking about straight away. And they don't need to actually quote the whole psalm. They only need this small couple of verses. It kind of acts as a shorthand to jog the memory of their readers. So, I think the point of this psalm that is quoted, the writer isn't just doing it out of fun. They're trying to make a point using it. Like in an essay, you'd make a point first, then use an example. And I'll say, I don't think it's immediately obvious what the point the writer is making is, but this is where we've got to. So the previous couple of verses are talking about the great salvation that Jesus brings. And then we have this phrase that's underlined, the world to come. Now, according to Chris's study Bible, it's a common Jewish phrase used to talk about the future age in which all God's purposes in salvation will be fulfilled. So in this first section, this first sentence, the writer sets up a question they're going to answer. Who is in charge of the world and who is to bring this world to come, this new salvation? And to answer this question, they quote Psalm 8. And as we'll hopefully see, the purpose of the quote is to say that God's plan was always to redeem and rescue the world through humanity, namely through Jesus. So let's read the relevant section of the psalm. Danette, would you mind reading it?
Which bit?
Just the psalm that's on the right.
Yeah. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them, human beings that you care for them? You have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet, all flocks and herds and the animals of the wild and the birds in the sky and the fish in the sea, all that swim the paths of the seas.
Brilliant, thank you. So this is a reflection, it's one of David's psalms, and it's his reflection. When you have that experience, when you see something beautiful in nature, something amazing, something overwhelming, you think, wow, this is so amazing. I'm so small. God is so big. And I think that's essentially what he's putting across. He ponders on how small humans seem in comparison to the created world. But he also reflects on the fact that God made humanity significant. We are a delegated ruler. It says, you've made them a little lower than the angels. We have a purpose. We've been commissioned as humanity to do amazing things. This is what we're here for. And the keen-eyed among you may notice that this psalm actually quotes another section of the Bible. Yeah, Genesis. Exactly. So, cast your mind back to the creation story. Okay, put it up, Chris, the next one. So God created, I'm not going to read it because you all probably know it, but God created humankind in his own image. He blessed them to fill the world and to subdue it. He created us with this purpose in mind. He gave us a job to rule. Humanity is not insignificant. We all have a role in God's world and we all reflect God's image in our own unique way and have our own purpose to fulfill, to flourish, to rule. Again, when Genesis is referenced in this psalm, the writer would expect the reader to know the whole story immediately in their heads. And you remember what happens next in the creation story, the next kind of big thing that happens, less fun, the fall. Mm-hmm. Oh, I can't see, it's Bill's in the way. There you go. That's my depiction of the fall, because there's too many verses to put on. So humanity turns away from God, right? They decide to make their own rules, and the rest is history. Now, it's interesting, because the writer of Hebrews doesn't actually quote anything to do with the fall, but because creation has been referenced through the psalm, it's assumed that the fall has already come into your mind. So let's go back to Hebrews and have a look. So Hebrews goes on to say, in the blue highlighted section, so in putting everything under them, God left nothing that is not subject to them. But at present, we do not see everything subject to them. We do not see everything in subjection to humanity on earth, do we? Things go wrong. People are hurt. Humanity has gone astray. We use our God-given power and rule selfishly. We abuse it to further our own interests or the interests of people that we like at the expense of other people. And we see this everywhere. You know, people want to get ahead and no one's going to get in my way. So the answer to that original question that the writer was asking doesn't look that rosy at the moment. sorry, Rosie. if the writer is saying that salvation comes through humanity, something's clearly gone wrong here. It's not working. So there's a problem with humanity. And next we see the writer explain how God addresses this problem. But we do see Jesus in yellow here, who was made lower than the angels for a little while, now crowned with glory and honour because he suffered death. Do you see how it's re-quoting the psalm? It's rereading that Old Testament quote in light of the new. He's putting Jesus right into that quote from the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So it says, Jesus, he was made a little lower than the angels. That is, he became human. But not only did he become human, he's become the only human who has ever used his God-given rule and power perfectly. He's become the ultimate human who teaches us what it really means to be truly human. And how did he do this? What was Jesus' main life event? He gave up his life for his enemies. This is how he achieved honour and glory. This is how he restored humanity and kick-started their road to glory. In green, I've highlighted, in bringing many sons and daughters to glory. So that's our journey of faith, our road to becoming more like Jesus. Our sanctification, to use the theological word for it. This is how he makes us a new creation. So Jesus, this is showing so amazingly how Jesus is the fulfillment of the psalm, but not only the psalm, but creation through that reference. Jesus is crowned with glory and honour because of his sacrifice, and he is the one who makes the way for us to be restored. So I made this little summary diagram. I have to try and put it all in one place because I was getting confused when trying to work through it all. So this is where we come back to that original question. Who is to bring this world to come, this new salvation? Well, it's fitting that God, the Creator, is the pioneer who brings this plan into being, who orchestrates the plan that spans all of human history. Because of Jesus, we are all restored and renewed, and we can all now walk in God's plans for us. So do you see how clever this argument is? The writer of Hebrews is making their argument, proving their thesis about God and his goodness and his amazing plan, that through humanity, through the ultimate human, through Jesus, his purposes are fulfilled. And I think the writer of Hebrews so cleverly shows us the echoes and seeds of this plan right from the beginning of the Old Testament. What was set in motion in Genesis was fulfilled in Jesus. And now, just a kind of side note, it's worth remembering that, you know, Genesis is an ancient poem about creation, and Psalm 8 is also a pretty old poem about David's prayers and reflections. Neither of these poets would have explicitly known about Jesus. They don't know God's future plan necessarily, but nor did they need to for their writing to be reinterpreted in this way. And why is that? Well, it's because we believe that the Bible was inspired by God. David didn't need to know about Jesus' specific story and future plan, because God was inspiring him and working through him and putting these seeds in, possibly without him even knowing. I'm just going to summarise from this diagram now, just to try and make sure we're all on the same page. What has the writer of Hebrews done, and how have they done it? So firstly, they set up the question. They say that they're going to tell us how great Jesus' salvation is, and that Jesus is the ultimate human that's going to fulfil God's purpose for humanity. And to do this, we have the first reference to Psalm 8. And then Psalm 8, in turn, references Genesis 1. And through all these quotes, the author's assuming that the reader actually knows the psalm and knows all of the creation narrative already. And much like the light of the world conjures up the whole psalm for us, this short quote brings to mind not just the psalm, but the entire creation narrative. And this technique that the writer's using is one of the key ones that they use throughout the book of Hebrews. And I think it's going to take us a bit of work to really get to grips with what they're trying to get across. You know, this is only a few verses got a whole book to get through. But hopefully you can see, when we break it down, you can see the kind of techniques that they're using, and hopefully it becomes a bit less intimidating. So yeah, it's all about reading the old in light of the new, reinterpreting the Old Testament with Jesus in mind. So, to finish, the Old Testament is important, and the writer shows us that the Old Testament isn't just some nice, interesting story, but that it's a continuation of God's plan. It's that first part of the story that Jesus came to finish. We understand Jesus so much better when we understand everything he came to fulfill. It's not just an interesting activity to look at these links between old and new, but in doing so, we actually discover core parts of Jesus' identity. So to finish, I'd like to encourage you to read Hebrews. My suggestion would actually be, first, ignore everything I've said and just read it front to back without looking at any of the references, just to get a feel of the flow of this sermon, even if you don't understand everything, because I certainly didn't when I did that. I think it's quite a good activity to start with. But then, as we go through the series, I'd like to encourage you to read through it as a family. Let's read through it at a slower pace as we kind of go through the different topics that come in the chapters, and try and look at some of these references in our own time as well. See how getting stuck into the Old Testament stories can really enrich our reading of the New Testament. Watch and marvel at how the writer of Hebrews reinterprets the old in light of the new, and see how this big story all points towards Jesus. I really believe that our concept of Jesus' identity will be widened and deepened throughout the next couple of months, and I'm really excited to do this together. So that's all I've got to say. Hopefully I haven't just confused you all more. Would somebody like to close in prayer? Maybe Sue, would you?